I don't want to exaggerate an interpretation which may not exist, but maybe clarify its intent. As I read it, it would apply not just to the military department, but presumably any federal activity to which, or for which, presumably a remedy under the these portions of the U.S. Code apply. I assume Federal Tort Claim Act would be affected, or is this just for military activities?
The we attempted to make it as broad as possible. Our intent is for the military type offense. I'm not aware of other areas that that there would be a similar exposure, but rather than the titles 5, 10, and 32 are the primary areas that relate to military activities, and the suggestion was that we include other federal laws. If there are amendments or other areas where there could be exposure, the same rationale should apply. In other words, it's not to eliminate a recovery, it's to limit a recovery to just one level, so that if the person were within the federal community, they'd still have that same limitation. An example is we don't have workman's compensation coverage per se for military. We have a system that is better. It's full pay and allowances for the individual in uniform that has a disabling injury, at least while they're still on active duty. So that's why we've used the word compensation program in here, because we can't use a workman's comp as a definition, and that's why we've attempted to cover the bases, if you will, in this language. But I do see it as the scope being extremely limited.
Okay, let me pose a hypothetical just so I understand it. What would happen if you had at least a couple defendants? So you had a military type activity that where compensation would be available under the federal some federal recoveries provided, and which I understand clearly you would want to make that the exclusive remedy. If there were another co-defendant part of the same conduct, and that body and that other defendant were a public body as well, would that public body still be liable under the State Tort Claim Act? Reading your language literally, I kind of want to make sure we have a correct interpretation if you have more than one defendant in terms of where you can go.
Okay, I can't see where there would be that another public body, unless they have a federal. Well,
let me pose a hypothetical to you. Let's say the National Guard is doing maneuvers, and they are asked the Department of Transportation to close off a certain area of roadways, and the Department of Transportation, arguably or it's alleged, is negligent because they haven't posted warnings and closed off a roadway. You've got military activities going on, someone goes down the roadway, and boom, there's an accident. That person arguably is going to have an action against the military activities, but they're probably also going to question whether or not the highway department had acted properly, say, in closing off an area. Now, they're going to want to bring an action against both bodies as co-defendants in the same action, or they may want to go to different courts, you know. But if they were to join those two as defendants, or they were to bring a third-party action in against the others, what's going to happen in those circumstances? Those are the questions I have, and I don't know if we can answer those questions today, but those are the things that kind of go through my mind.
I see it as possibly a problem if the highway department and the military department were joined as co-defendants. If the highway department was named as a separate defendant, I don't think this would be a limitation. I'm trying to give a quick analysis of that situation. I don't profess to be a expert on pleading and all in that that particular situation, but I think what we're the reason we wanted to expand to other public bodies is your hypothetical situation is quite often when we're in a Title 32 status, we're performing services maybe for the Highway Department, for the Forestry Department, Fish and Wildlife, other state or federal agencies, and we were attempting to set up, make it broad enough so that it wouldn't preclude, or that we still have the single recovery, if you will, not giving two bites at the apple just because it happened to be this narrow area where there was not an exclusive remedy situation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Burton.
Colonel, let me try a little further, because I think the question's well put. Let's say an individual is on active duty, and then he comes at that point, I assume, under Title 32, when he is on active duty at, now there's two ways to do that. You can go on active duty at federal orders, or you can come on active duty at state. You're assuming it comes under federal orders.
If it's a Title 10 order, there's no problem. It's an exclusive remedy. It's only when it's in the Title 32 status that there's a hiatus.
Okay. And if we had someone on duty, and to take Representative Springer's example, to the point where a uniformed military individual is run over or hit by a Department of Transportation vehicle and injured to the point of loss of limbs or something like that, that individual, if what you're saying would that his, where's the person's remedy under?
Okay,
what title?
First, the individual who is, say, a National Guardsman who's performing Title 32 duty would not have a cause of action against the military department, or the would not have a cause of action. That one is going to be the remedy is against is back under the workman's compensation type of coverage, or in other words, the incapacitation pay area on that. Now, if let's see, who was the defendant again? Was that the Department of Transportation? Okay, pardon me. On that one, he does have a claim. He would have a claim
under Title 32.
Yes, he would have an independent claim, regardless of whether he was Title 10 or Title 32. That's a third party defendant. He's going to have a cause of action against those individuals. Pardon me. Those bodies.
Yeah, that answers my question, Brian. It raises some questions.
Can I volunteer something?
Mr. Murphy.
I've done some work in the Ferries Doctrine. I've had a couple of cases involving that. I had to take the U.S. District Court to the Ninth Circuit to get myself up from underneath the Ferries Doctrine in a particular matter. The thing that bothers me is if we have a situation where the government, U.S. government, would be involved and a state agency would be involved in it, we have a limitation as to what way you could go. You could only sue the government if the federal court claims. In the federal court, you can only sue the state and the state court. And you have an election situation, and you don't know what to elect on, you have a real difficult situation, whether you have to elect to pursue it in the state court or pursue it in the federal court. And if you have some sort of election where you're limited to one of the two, I think it would be very difficult to make that particular choice.
Ms. Nestle?
Yes, Chairman Kopeski, members of the committee, I think it would be very simple to address one of the problems that was presented in Representative Springer's original hypothetical, where you had a co-defendant that was not involved in the military affairs and a co-defendant who was, and that amendment would be that no public body would have liability under this chapter. If a remedy is available with respect to the claim asserted against that public body under the Federal Tort Claims Act or these others, and that way you could there would be a claim that would be involved underneath either the workers' comp type remedy or so forth with respect to the military agency. But if there was an independent co-defendant of another state agency with a percentage of the fault, you could still be able to maintain it under the Tort Claims Act against that independent entity. I think that one thing that has to be emphasized here is, number one, the fact that outside of the military conduct, or context, you'll almost never find a federal court holding that a state agency or the officer, agent, or employee of a state agency, even if he's working or she is working in a cooperative federal program, being deemed an agent of the federal government that the Tort Claims Act covers. It just hardly ever happens. I am not even aware of a federal case in which that has been held, outside, of course, of the unique circumstances of state military involvement. Okay.
Representative Springer.
Well, it's been an interesting discussion, but I'm just procedurally at this point, I don't think I'm prepared to act on this language, and I think maybe the procedure might be to ask these parties to work together on language, if possible, to bring to the full committee. I hate to hold up. It looks like there's been a lot of work into this bill already. I don't want to dismiss out of hand the Colonel's issue here, but I'm reluctant to spend too much more time this afternoon in the work session to resolve it without having an opportunity for the parties, perhaps themselves, to get together and make sure we've chosen the language very carefully to do so. It may be that they are unable to agree, and if that's the case, I suppose we'll have to reach some other decision in full committee.
I know, as far as the military department, we'd be very happy to do that, because our intent is not to provide broad exemptions or take away the cause of action of defendants, except in this one limited area where there is a double recovery potential, and be very happy to work with the trial lawyers and with the Attorney General's office on this.
Okay, why don't I ask that Nestle and Colonel and our counsel and either Mr. Murphy or somebody from Mr. Marquis's organization to try to agree upon some language, and hopefully we would be able to have this before the full committee on Wednesday. But that's plenty of time, I think, to. It's only a few sentences. Yes, thank you. Unless there are other questions from the committee, thank you, gentlemen, very much for this discussion and information. Representative Bott.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendments marked in the top right, preliminary draft subject to change, amendments to House Bill 2285, as I've outlined.
Representative Bott moves the amendments, preliminary draft subject to change, amendments to House Bill 2285, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Fetzke?
Aye. Motion approved. Burton? Thank you very much.
Do we not move the bill?
Oh, is that just an amendment?
Yes.
Well, okay. Yes, sir, Representative Bunn.
I would move House Bill 2285 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bunn moves House Bill 2285 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Fetzke?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Well, people, I think we're down to our last bill, Friday afternoon, House Bill 2468.
Chairperson. You have in front of you the latest set of amendments proposed by Ms. Rogers, dated May 15, 1985. As you recall, this bill deals with state debts, and I believe Ms. Rogers has worked out several of the amendments with the parties involved and is here to speak to them.
Okay. Ms. Rogers?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid in Portland. And the version that you should be working from is the May 15th mock-up. I should note that in the last Legislative Council draft, there was one small error where a number was not changed, but we'll see where we get, whether we need to work on that. The page 1 and 2 and on to page 3 of the bill, we've made a few changes after working with Larry Young, the Attorney General, who was, and also the Support Enforcement Division people. They were helpful on language. It still does the same thing. It does not permit the state debt to accumulate until there has been notice and a finding of financial responsibility, except in the case where there has been intentional evasion of service, basically. On page 3 of the bill, we get to section 4 on line 24, which prescribes a sixth grade readability standard for the form and notice with an eighth grade exception for vocabulary alone. I think this is extremely important dealing with low-income people. And then on page 4, we get to some changes in the bill that was presented to you originally. What we're doing in the new language after page line 14 on page 4 is we are looking at a single hearing and a single summons in most cases in the juvenile court setting. And in the summons that is going to go out to parents and children in terms of the juvenile court's jurisdiction over the child, there will be a notice that the parent may have to pay. And then the Children's Services Division is to gather financial data for the court to have. And at the dispositional hearing, or as down below on, in line 21, at an earlier time or at any other time as the court may direct, and I'll explain why that is in a minute. At the dispositional hearing, the financial situation is to be clarified, determined, and the order for payment to the state is to be made. This is to have one hearing only on the issue, not a hearing 8 months later that SED has to set up, to do it at the time when 95% of the parents are already before the court, which is the case in the CSD proceedings before juvenile court, and it does add a few minutes to most hearings because the court is going to have to determine the financial ability to pay. Mr. Linden is here. He can, from the State Court Administrator's Office, he can talk to you about some of the feelings of some of the judges he has talked to about why this system makes sense to them.
Mr. Linden?
Subsection 3 still deals, we've clarified the language and it's very hard to read, but it still deals with the juvenile training schools, McLaren, and children's incarceration in those institutions, and we make an exception to parental responsibility in the juvenile training schools and the training camps, and saying that there should be no parental responsibility because this is a societal function. It is basically jail. We have conformed some other statutory language. 418 also deals with the Children's Services Division. We had to make the exception on page 5 for children committed to juvenile training schools. And then finally, we've only slightly changed the requirement that the Children's Services Division on voluntary placements in foster care should have to give both oral and written notice to parents that they are going to have to pay by giving the Children's Services Division an out. If they didn't give the notice, we said they never could collect any amount of money from the parents. This is now amended in conjunction with the Attorney General's office to say that they can't collect until they have given the notice. So that is the bill as it is before you. It raises a substantial number of policy questions. We have not resolved those policy issues with the Attorney General's office. We have worked on the language only. And I would like to point out before I finish that the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. One of the possibilities that the committee might want to consider is to make all or part of the bill effective July 1st, 1987, and try to move to get the subsequent referral to Ways and Means repealed or deleted, lifted, whatever.
Ms. Linden, did you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Board Administrator. There are some positive things and some not so positive things that we feel that are included in this bill. I personally talked to a number of juvenile judges about the problem of notice to parents of these debts, and they said that it is a significant problem, that too often the timeliness of the notice is just severely lacking, and it causes them problems in terms of sometimes having been asked to explain what is going on here. The concern, on the other hand, that we have is this is going to increase court hearing time. And the result will be that it'll take more time to do fewer cases, and the delay problem that we experience will be exacerbated. We think probably something like 10 or 15 minutes would be added to dispositional hearings, assuming that the financial information was all in front of the court and complete and accurate. In terms of the actual language of the bill, however, the change in the notice requirement that's put on the court is to our liking. Earlier it had been a notice that we would have to include some very detailed information. Now simply requires that in our summons to the parent there be a generic statement about the possibility that the parent may have to contribute to the child's the parent maybe have some financial responsibility. It is also agreeable to us that it may be that SCD is a more appropriate body to collect the financial information than CSD, but that someone bring that information to the juvenile court judge so they have that at the time of the disposition hearing. Again, the main problem we have is the increase in hearing time, but again, our juvenile judges have identified the notice problems as an issue which they think is a valid one. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Belnick.
Not questions, no. I really strongly support all aspects of the bill with exception one. And I think I've made it very clear to the committee I do not agree with the concept of eliminating the McLaren and Hillcrest. It's a policy decision with me, and at that point in time, I still believe that the parents ought to be responsible for the care of the children if they have financial ability to do so. I just believe that sooner or later it becomes easier to put them into let them go to McLaren and Hillcrest because then their financial responsibility ends, and I don't like that concept. The other concept that I think is something that the committee ought to look at is that this bill does have a fiscal impact. I would really look at the idea of making it become effective in 2 years with the request to CSD and the juvenile courts that in the next 2 years they start implementing it. I personally don't see any reason why that could not be done. If it's the policy of the state to start doing it, if they had 2 years to start implementing it, start putting it together, I don't think the fiscal impact would be that great. And by all means, if they did a better job of informing the parents, they might actually do a better job of collecting some money. So that's my position.
Other comments from the committee members?
I guess one further comment, Mr. Chairman. I really hate to, there's a lot of good things in this bill, and I really hate to see it sent down to Ways and Means because I have a feeling that's exactly where it will sit. And then for 2 years, the agencies will not be implementing any changes that I think are very appropriate changes, waiting for money. And maybe it isn't a good way to do things, but I also believe maybe making it effective in 2 years would give them the chance to really get busy and implement it.
Representative Bellamy, I haven't considered a 2 year effective date. I guess if you want to move that amendment or these other amendments as well, I'd accept that motion. I'm personally hesitant to vote yes at this point, although I could be outvoted number one, or would consider that in full committee. Whichever your choice and the rest of the subcommittee's choice is.
Mr. Chairman, let's try it this way.
Sure.
To give us a little more time to think on that, I would move to amend House Bill 2468 with all the amendments proposed by the amendments prepared by Terry Rogers, Legal Aid, May 15th, 1985, with the exception of those amendments, and they're generally found on page 4 on lines 15, 16, and 17 that deal with eliminating McLaren and Hillcrest from the parents being able to charge. And Mr. Chairman, I will not move the 2 year effective date until full committee if that goes and gives the subcommittee a little more time to think about that proposal and discuss it.
Okay, why don't, let's see, I'll restate the motion then. Representative Bellamy moves the amendments prepared by Terry Ann Rogers, dated May 15, 1985. But not including on page 4 the deletions of lines 15, 16, and 17, and the intent being
yes, and that's
that parents would be
amendments to those lines. I don't want to just eliminate all of the wording there necessarily.
Right. Restoring the original language.
Right.
And intent. Yes. Are there objections to the amendment? Representative Burke.
I need to understand something here anyway. Do, maybe I said somewhere, parents are not required to, for anyone being incarcerated in those facilities now, are they required to pick up those payments? And that's the reason for that fiscal impact.
No. Mike, that isn't the reason for the fiscal impact. They don't get much from their billing now. The fiscal impact comes from the requirement of all the information for the dispositional hearings. We should have somebody here. There's a whole lot of things to this bill that technically require fiscal impact. It isn't necessarily the collections of Hillcrest and McLaren.
Okay, well, let me just address the amendment then. Because I think the amendment is a question. We'll get back to Ways and Means question in a minute. I think that my concern here is that I disagree with the premise for the exclusion of those. The juvenile training schools essentially are training, and I think there probably is a question in my mind is when does the responsibility trade off from the parents to the society for maintenance of those children? My guess is that if we get to the point where an individual is by the courts or other means ordered to go into McLaren for incarceration, which is effectively jail, that the parental responsibility aspect of control of that child has already somewhere been lost, because that child has committed an offense against society, and therefore we have, I think, under our current state policies, assumed some responsibility for that. So the question of whether the parents should or ought, I think they've already lost, unfortunately, their obligation and their responsibility and their opportunity to have dealt with that child in a different manner, and it's become an issue that's generally society's in general. So I'm not too sure that I thought your reason for deleting that Representative Bellamy, was because that would be where the impact on the Ways and Means issue would be. That isn't it, and I'm not sure, I would have an objection to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
Let me respond. That isn't, my objection is not the fiscal impact. It's strictly a philosophy policy issue that I believe that even when children are sent to the McLaren Institution or the Hillcrest Institution, if the parents are capable financially, they ought to pay for part of the board and room, and we should say, simply because for the vast majority of the time, when the children are released, they're released back to their parents, and the probation is usually conditioned upon things that happen back home. And I will also tell you that we're not talking about a great number of parents who have ability to pay. I mean, you know, we're not talking about the upper crust of society, but most of the juveniles, let's face it.
Representative Springer.
Well, just for a moment on the policy side of it, I've had some but very limited experience in terms of trying to help some folks caught in this dilemma. And I think I understand what Representative Bellamy is saying in terms of his concern that somehow there might be an incentive to put the kid